do not cut this out of the interview. That is for us.
I feel like we just had a backdoor pilot for a basketball podcast in the middle of our discussion about Palestine. From Topic Studios and WarnerMedia Podcast Network, this is Politically Reactive. I'm Debbie Kamau Bell.
And I'm Hari Kondabolu, a.k.a. the 1993 PS115 Spelling Bee runner-up. That's right, defying stereotypes, an Indian American lost the Spelling Bee. But to be fair, another Indian American won the Spelling Bee, so you know.
We're two friends in stand-up comics and dads trying to make sense of American politics.
That's very, very hard. But probably still easier than trying to get people to talk rationally about Israel and Palestine, which is the topic of today's episode.
The Palestinian people are not protected. They live in a state of inequality and injustice and oppression and occupation.
Don't start your angry tweets yet. Just first listen to our conversation with our guest, Mark Lamont Hill.
Mark's new book is Except for Palestine, The Limits of Progressive Politics.
We say stuff like, oh, well, Israel has a right to exist. Israel has a right to defend itself. Those people have been fighting forever. Why don't we blame Hamas? They need to stop terrorism. And instead of unpacking those kinds of statements and getting somewhere better and smarter so we can have a lasting peace for everybody, we just say, we'll leave it.
Mark knows what it's like to face backlash for speaking out in defense of Palestinians.
In 2018, CNN dropped him as a commentator the day after he spoke to the UN on its annual Day of Solidarity with Palestinian people.
But he's kept at it. As a progressive black scholar, he feels it's his responsibility.
I think there's such an opportunity with this issue to not just be an issue about Israelis and Palestinians, but to be a referendum on a bigger conversation about what justice might look like and how it might feel. And that, for me, is super interesting.
Trigger warning for Knicks fans. It should be noted that Mark does have some questionable views about the National Basketball Association. We'll get into it.
And after you talk to Mark, we're going to bring on another black scholar and author to talk about her experience of getting the COVID-19 vaccine, my mom, Janet Cheatham Bell.
Do we want to spend the rest of our lives social distancing and wearing masks? I don't. I love my family, but I'd like to see some friends from time to time.
Man, I love Janet. I'm so happy she's on. However, it doesn't mean I gotta find a way to get my mom on, but the season's almost over.
So you're just gonna call her Janet like you guys went to high school together, like you took her to prom or something?
Well, I would have if it was possible.
Ugh. It's all coming up on Politically Reactive.
Hey, W. Kamau Bell, how are you?
I'm fine. Continue, sir. How you doing?
I'm frustrated with Joe Biden, Kamau.
Get ready for four more years of that.
I was frustrated, and people are like, yeah, but at least he's not Trump. Like, okay, yeah, at least my foot's not broken. At least my head's still attached to my body. Like, what does that mean? It's not an ideal situation for somebody who wants to, like, not just better than the worst, right?
Yeah.
My hope was they would forgive $50,000 in student loans, right? Which, to be fair, Joe Biden for a while said he wasn't going to do.
Yeah.
He's not like he just, he's like, no, I'm shittier than that.
He didn't lie
that.
About it. Just always hoping he would get better.
But he just, I'm like, there must be enough pressure where he'll go up to 20 or 25 like 50. And you thought
it was a negotiation.
And it wasn't. He's like, nah, 10. And so there's that. Then I read an article. Apparently he told governors privately that the $15 minimum wage that has been proposed will not happen, which is like, what? That's not even a COVID thing. That's like a human decency thing. Like, people deserve a living wage. Mm-hmm. Like, even Amazon's paying their people $15. Like, what are we doing right now? And it just bothers me because, I mean, it's not shocking. It's just, oh, shit, we elected Joe Biden? I mean, this is what happens when you elect Joe Biden. But it's just like, I don't understand how these things will hurt the country. Like, the $50,000 thing, it's like, He says stuff about how, why should people, with good paying jobs who went to Harvard and Yale get forgiven that money too? And it's like, just because you went to Harvard and Yale, and let's say you're making $100,000 a year, that doesn't mean you're not in lots of debt. Because if you have the loans, that means you didn't start out with money. And if you're in debt, it means you actually like beat expectations, or you sacrificed a great deal to go to a really expensive college, and you're being penalized for it for many years. So there's cases of people who, let's say, want to work in the nonprofit sector as a lawyer or contribute to their you know, the communities. They can't do it because mm-hmm. they're so in debt. They have to make money, and that's it. So $10,000, I get it. It's not nothing, but like, come on, Joe Biden, I thought you were supposed to connect with the average man and stuff. I thought that was that's good old Uncle Joe. Uncle Joe.
Nope.
That's it. I mean, I got nothing. I mean, it's just.
I mean, I think the problem is that this sort of this false narrative. You don't want rich people to benefit from this thing, so let's make poor people suffer more. Like, just when in reality, the minute you start to what they call means testing, to sort of go, well, you have to prove how much money you aren't making so you can get the benefit of the thing, you always end up losing a lot more people who could use, if you just said everybody gets this. So I love the fact that town hall, when the person asked Joe Biden about it, is like, what are you going to do to get to? And he's like, I'm not going to do anything to get to $50,000. Like, it was just like,
I'm sorry, but I'm Joe Biden.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like that. I don't know if you realize how gangster that sounded in the moment. I think he thought he was being honest, and it sounded like, whoa, okay. The people who got Joe Biden elected were not the millionaire, billionaire donors. It was not the Wall Street fat cats, as they used to say. It was not the DNC. It was activists and organizers, people of color, black-led, indigenous-led in places like Arizona, and also, as we've talked about, Georgia, who were like, look, Joe Biden's not the best president we could have ever created, but we need to get back this country back on a better track, so we will get him elected. And now I think it's up to all of us to hold those receipts to Joe Biden and go, we're the ones who got you elected. Did you like that getting elected thing? Have you enjoyed being elected?
Quick side note. These motherfuckers don't tell you this, but a lot of times when you're repaying your student loans, you can pay off the principal. You don't just need to like pay back the money. Specifically, you should ask to pay off the principal so you're not paying off solely the interest forever. But they don't tell you that because it's a fucking business.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's a fucking business as opposed to something that is... What is the point? And this will segue neatly into our next topic, Kamau.
Great.
What is the fucking point of government if they are going to privatize education and loans and privatize electricity and privatize water and privatize healthcare? The minimum the government's supposed to do, the fucking minimum, is to get your basic needs met. I thought that was the deal when we decided to enter this agreement that was never actually agreed to, but we were born into. I thought we had to get that much. And then the rest of it, I get it. Okay, we want an iPhone. We gotta work for it. But this shit... Are you kidding me? It's like getting a ticket to a plane. You get there, and then you got to rent the fucking seat.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
They're not going to give you a meal, obviously. The seatbelt you got to pay for, right? And then you finally land. To get off the plane, you got to pay money.
I mean, to be fair, you just described Spirit Airlines' business model. Just That's basically their business model. Oh, you want to sit down on the plane? Oh, well, that's going to cost you. Oh, you want to wear clothes on the plane? That's an extra weight. That's going to cost you.
America, the Spirit Airlines of countries.
Oh, you want to get off the plane? Oh, you didn't say that when you got on the plane. I think we have this idea of what America is, and what we've learned over the last 4 years is that the idea of what government is in our minds, and even what they tell us what it is a lot of times, is not true, and you only find out when the shit hits the fan, you know, which takes us to Texas. That if there's any state in the country where their utility bills should be zero, it's Texas, based on the fact that it happens to just be on a place that has lots of natural resources. That everybody in Texas should be like, oh, we don't pay for electricity and gas because we live on top of electricity and gas.
Right.
And that's not what happened in Texas, the parts that got hit by the cold and got hit by the snow and were in the deep freeze. People found out how much their utility companies care about them. And yes, a lot of that's out of the utilities company control when the weather hits and suddenly everything goes haywire. But the response is the problem.
Because why is it privatized?
Yeah.
It's electricity.
Yeah, that's the thing. You don't think about that. And Texas has been deregulated because they like to think that they're their own, that it's the old West. And so a lot of their utilities are deregulated, which means anybody can be like, hi, my name's Tommy. I want to sell you some electricity. anybody can get into that business. And what people find out is it's not good when that stuff isn't regulated. It's not good when the government doesn't really take charge of that. One of those things that happened, I found out about, was a Texas company called Gritty, G-R-I-D-D-Y, not to be confused with Gritty, the Philadelphia Flyers mascot. Apparently, the way Gritty is set up, it's because it's a deregulated market in Texas, is that Gritty and is allowed to charge customers wholesale variable rates for their utilities. The idea being that, like, the rate varies so that over time you end up paying less because the rate goes up and down. And if it goes down enough, that you will end up paying less. So, you know, it's like basically it like turns your utility bill into the stock market. And when the storm happened and it threw everything into an upside down whirlwind, the people who had Gritty found out that they were suddenly getting charged a lot, even if they didn't have access to the power. And some people's bills for that period of time went up to like $5,000, $17,000. Because they were being charged for the fact that during that period of time, the price of energy went up quite a lot.
And this is what they signed up for.
Here's the thing. Capitalism will sell you a lot of things. If you buy this car, you'll have more sex. You know what I mean?
This isn't to blame the people that are, you know what I mean? But they did not expect any of this. They expected some accountability. Because you sign up for electricity and you assume that is something that people will handle because it's electricity and there will be some fairness. Like, no way I'm going to be in debt for something I'm not even getting when I need.
And that the system wouldn't have any sort of fail safe for like, oops, no one wants to pay $17,000 for their electricity bill, their energy bill. We should really make sure that doesn't happen. Nope. They just go ahead and go. You go ahead and go, oh, that's what I'm supposed to pay. Meanwhile, your Senator Ted Cruz and his wife, according to the New York Times, where they have the text, decided, oh, a storm is coming. Why don't we go to Cancun, Mexico? Why don't we make a run for the border and stay at a fancy resort so we don't have to deal with all this cold?
Good thing I don't have a job that makes me accountable to people. Good thing I could be caught doing this.
Yeah, what can I do? I'm just a senator. What can I be expected to do? And meanwhile, at the same time, AOC, Beto O'Rourke, AOC, who is a congressperson, ended up raising millions of dollars for Texas relief. And Beto O'Rourke, who I think is just a professor at a university in Texas now, apparently was responsible for putting together people to reach out to make over 150,000 wellness checks to find out who needed help, older people, older Texans who needed help, and got people help. If you look at Beto O'Rourke's career, the way you look at like the Rocky series, Rocky 1 is where he got the moral victory for running against Ted Cruz, but he didn't get the actual victory because in Rocky 1, Rocky doesn't win the fight, but people go, you did better than we thought. That was Rocky 1. That was Beto O'Rourke against Ted Cruz. And then Rocky 2 starts and Rocky doesn't want to fight anymore. So he like gets a job like trying to like be a spokesperson in commercials and that doesn't work. And you find out Rocky's functionally illiterate. It's very sad. Rocky 2, it's a good movie. That's Beto O'Rourke running for president. Like, what were you doing? What were you doing running for president? Yeah. That was not your move after losing the Senate seat. This is Beto O'Rourke. Bum, 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 bum. He's setting himself up perfectly to actually do what he should have done in the first place and run again against Ted Cruz in the Senate.
Wait a second, Kamau. You don't think this attractive white man with just a little political experience just did this because he cares about the state of Texas?
You can do both.
You don't think this was solely to help the people of Texas without leading to any other thing? This attractive white man who ran for Senate way too soon because he has the confidence of a white man.
Yeah, as he said, he was born for this, as he said on the cover of some white
people. He actually said that?
I think Vanity Fair, I think. He had to walk it back. He had to walk it back. I'm just saying that, like, if you were ever thinking about running for a Senate against Ted Cruz again, Beto O'Rourke, this was a good way to get back there and also help some people in the process, which is what politics is supposed to be doing. We can't take the ego out of politics, but why don't you do some good work while you're stroking your own ego? See, Ted Cruz is just about the ego stroke without any of the work.
Fucking Ted Cruz. First Zodiac killing and now this. Also, his dad killed JFK. Sorry. Okay. I'm joking. This is some nonsense QAnon shit. Like,
You're not serious? You're not serious, are you?
I don't want to send a coded signal to all my QAnon fans. Man, I'm really looking forward to this conversation with Mark Lamont Hill. We talk about Texas. We talk about his new book, Except for Palestine, The Limits of Progressive Politics. We talked about the racial divide around the COVID vaccine, who's getting it, who's afraid of it. And after that, we're going to be hearing from a very special guest.
I like to call that special guest my mom. My mom has gotten the COVID vaccine. I wanted to talk to her about what it was like, because I haven't talked to her since she got the vaccine, because we're not that close. Just kidding. But I do want her to talk about it on the podcast, talk about what it was like, why she got it, if she hesitated to get it at all. And also wanted to talk about the greater context of the history of Black folks in America and healthcare and how that played into her thoughts about it. It's going to be a good one. Mark Lamont Hill is a professor of media studies at Temple University.
He's a BET News correspondent, and he'll soon start hosting the Al Jazeera English show Upfront. He's also a former political commentator with Fox News and CNN.
CNN let him go in 2018 after Mark made a speech as part of the UN's annual Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people.
We have an opportunity to not just offer solidarity in words, but to commit to political action. Grassroots action, local action, and international action that will give us what justice requires. And that is a free Palestine from the river to the sea.
The Anti-Defamation League said that the phrase, a free Palestine from the river to the sea, was Hamas code for calling for the destruction of Israel. Mark apologized for using the phrase, but the next day he was out at CNN.
But that experience has not kept him away from this or other controversial subjects. At the end of 2020, he published We Still Here, Pandemic, Policing, Protest, and Possibility. And to begin 2021, he and his co-author Mitchell Plitnick have come out with Except for Palestine, The Limits of Progressive Politics.
Let's talk to Mark. Welcome to the show, Mark Lamont Hill.
Man, good to see you guys, man. Happy to be here.
Thank you for agreeing to do this. We appreciate it.
Oh, man, it's a pleasure, man. The fact that I still get invited to a few places is always a surprise. So I take every opportunity.
Well, you always got a home in anything I'm doing, as I hope you know. When I close my eyes, I picture I'm you. It makes me feel better about myself. It's like, I have degrees. I'm a professor. I write a lot of books.
I do that with Hasan Minhaj, to be honest. But
there we go.
We all got one.
So first of all, the thing that I want to give you credit for is you do the thing that people think I do, but you do it more than I do it, if that makes any sense. You regularly engage with people that on the surface, it doesn't seem like you would have anything to talk about with. That is like one of your moves. Like I'm thinking about your podcast with Buck Sexton, thinking about when you used to work at Fox News, thinking about a clip I watched with my mouth open where you and Candace Owens had a conversation.
Oh, man. That was an adventure.
Yeah, well, I mean, you had to know going in that was going to be an adventure, right?
I'm a prisoner of hope, you know? I thought, I always believe that if I am reasonable and listen and impatient, that I can get outcomes that other people won't. And most of the time that works. But the person has to be willing to engage in good faith and they have to be smart. And if either one of those things aren't true, then things can go awry. I'm not saying anything about Candace in particular, I'm just making a general declaration. Yes.
Yes, yes, yeah. But you seem to be, I mean, just in general, that it's that hope that keeps you coming back to those conversations?
Yeah. I never, when I was on Fox News, people would say, do you really think you're going to beat Bill O'Reilly in a debate? And I think I beat Bill every night. The question really is, will Bill admit that he lost on any given night? And there was one or two times where I had backed him into a corner. He said, you know what? You're right. Right. But that's one or two out of like 500 appearances. Wow. But I don't have those engagements to persuade my debate partner. You know, nowhere on cable news does the person say, you know what? You got a good point. I was wrong. Let's just go to commercial. Right. Like you got to die on that hill every night. My hope is that the person watching the debate is persuaded by it. That's what I watch. So when I was on Fox News, I knew Bill or Hannity or whoever wasn't going to change their mind. But I got so many emails and letters half of which, you know, taught me new racial expletives, but the other half taught me something else, which was that people can be changed. They'd be like, you know what, I don't agree with you on much, but the way you said that thing about guns, or the way you said that thing about free speech, or the way you said that thing about whatever, that was a game changer. And so that's why I do the work.
I mean, I think that segues pretty neatly into, like, maybe the toughest thing that in this country, for sure, it seems like, or maybe around the world, that people can talk about, which is Israel and Palestine. Like, that is something, like, as soon as you even start the discussion, there's blood in the water. Like, people are immediately like, okay, something's about to happen. You know, I guess the first question is, how did you become an advocate for the Palestinian people?
I've been doing activist work since I was a teenager. I joined a couple of organizations out of one in North and one in West Philly when I was 15. And most of it was like police brutality, you know, stuff like that. A lot of it was post-Rodney King kind of responses to, you know, what we thought we could do about policing. And we weren't nearly as radical as we should have been, or as we could have been in retrospect, but we were doing our best. And so that brought me into a whole activist world. Also, Black bookstores brought me into a whole activist world. You know, I grew up, I cut my teeth in Black bookstores and my Uncle Bobby's house, which is the name of my bookstore. And between those two things, I just read widely and broadly. After reading Malcolm X, which was really a book that changed my life, I converted to Islam and I read a lot of stuff and I joined a lot of organizations and movements, and it made me very interested in what was happening, not just here, but in the Middle East, on the continent of Africa, etc. Largely, I was concerned with sort of what it meant to be Black around the world. And some of those questions took me to the Middle East, really Sudan and Egypt more than Palestine, but it took me into that region. I kind of put that stuff on hold as I did other kinds of work. And then as I circled back to TV and doing journalism and working at HuffPost, where we had a lot of international stories, the issues around Palestine were really heating up. In 2014, two things happened. There was the Ferguson summer, where we were all down, not all, but many of us were in Ferguson either reporting or being activists or organizing or dealing with the killing of Michael Brown. And also at that same time, the Gaza war was happening. Operation Protective Edge was happening in Gaza for 51 days in July and August of 2014. And so there was a lot of Ferguson to Palestine conversation. There was a lot of debate about what should be happening. And I was on cable news network talking about Gaza, debating people like Alan Dershowitz and others. And so all of those things kind of brought me closer to the issue that I had studied and knew about for all the reasons I just said. But I became closer to it around that time. And then that January, I went on a delegation that brought some of the founders of Black Lives Matter, some Ferguson activists and others to Palestine on what was called a Ferguson to Palestine delegation. And that delegation, in many ways, was life-changing because it took what I knew as an abstract idea and stuff that I've been debating for years, and it put it squarely in front of me. And so seeing the West Bank, seeing what happens in Ramallah, seeing what happens in Bethlehem, or being inside of Israel and seeing what happens to Palestinians who have citizenship but not equal rights, changed the game for me. And I also started doing academic research there. I started studying the Afro-Palestinian community. And so all that happened, and it just brought me close to the issue. It's not the only issue I care about. I care about Black folk in America. That's my primary mission. That's my call. But I think solidarity brings me into that space as well.
As often happens, I feel like this happens with me a lot. The thing that you're thinking about or the thing you're studying, suddenly the news goes, now we're thinking about it too. Or there's some sort of pop culture moment that reflects that. And yeah. As we're getting ready for this interview to bring you on, I see Michael Che trending on Twitter. I'm like, yeah-oh.
Shout out to Michael Che.
What did he do this time? Michael Che trending is not an unusual thing. He likes to push the edges and push the lines. Line between comedian and troll is a very blurry line. So I was like, let me click on this and find out what's going on with him. And I see all the commentary about it, about he said something anti-Semitic. And I was like, oh, no, Michael Che, what did you do? You know?
Right.
And then I played the joke and I was like, huh.
Israel is reporting that they vaccinated half of their population. And I'm going to guess it's the Jewish half.
That's the whole joke. 7 seconds.
Yeah. Like it was a GIF link joke. And I was, and it was just the reaction to it. There is interest, and you don't even go close to that discussion. We don't want anybody in the area of that discussion.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, to be clear, what Michael Che was joking about, the whole spirit of the joke was that he was saying that Palestinians are oppressed, right? I mean, it's a classic oppression joke, you know. If we were here in the United States and a similar joke were made, you know, we'd say it was the white half, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that Jews are white and Palestinians are black, just for those listening. I'm not equating those two things. It is purely a comparison, right? But the idea here is that he's speaking to that. So if you want to be a literalist, no, of course, it's not just Jewish people in Israel who are getting vaccinated. They've vaccinated half the population. That includes what they will call the Arab, what we will call the Palestinian population, right? If you're a citizen of Israel, you get vaccinated. That's a fact, right? You don't have to be Jewish to get vaccinated. Even people in East Jerusalem are getting vaccinated. That's a fact. The problem isn't that. The problem is a whole bunch of folk who live, who are occupied by Israel in the West Bank aren't getting vaccinated. Palestinians aren't getting vaccinated. They're saying all the Israeli Palestinians are getting vaccinated. Yeah, the problem is there's millions who can't get citizenship, you know? And so it's a technicality. Is the number 49%? No, of course not. Is the number 51%? Of course not. But the fact is that if you're Palestinian and you're not an Israeli citizen, you're jacked up. 17.5% of Israel is Palestinian. So the Palestinian population in that area largely isn't getting vaccinated. And the bigger issue here is that they're supposed to be. The Israeli government would say, well, that's not our responsibility. Ask Hamas to do it. Ask the Palestinian Authority to do it. Ask the people in those regions to do it. The issue, though, is that's not what international law says. The Geneva Convention says...
Hold up. Wait a minute.
The Geneva Conventions were four treaties agreed to in 1949 in reaction to the rampant war crimes committed in World War II. In 1951, Israel ratified the Geneva Conventions, as has every other member country of the United Nations.
The Fourth Geneva Convention deals specifically with the protection of civilian persons in time of war, including treatment of civilians under the control of an occupying power. Because Israel never withdrew from the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem after the Six-Day War in 1967, those territories were and still are considered occupied under international law. Article 56 of the Fourth Geneva Convention deals specifically with medicine and healthcare. Here's the relevant bit.
To the fullest extent of the means available to it, the occupying power has the duty of ensuring and maintaining, with the cooperation of national and local authorities, the medical and hospital establishments and services, public health and hygiene in the occupied territory, with particular reference to the adoption and application of the prophylactic and preventive measures necessary to combat the spread of contagious diseases and epidemics. I don't think Jay-Z wrote that.
And that's why, after 53 years of occupation, international law still requires Israel to help make sure Palestinians who live outside its borders, but under its control, get the COVID vaccination. You know, that, for the first time in a long while, it felt like my master's in human rights was not completely wasted.
Good job, sir.
What they're trying to argue is that because of the peace deal that was made in 1993, the Oslo Accords, that suddenly the Palestinian Authority has a responsibility to do that. But there's actually a provision in the Oslo Accords that says that has an exception for what? Widespread infectious diseases. I think Corona counts as one. So that's the spirit, that's the backdrop of all of this, right? The anti-Semitic argument is that and this is very true, there's a long history of blaming Jewish people for harm that they did not do. There's a long history of what they call blood libel. They used to blame Jews for the death of small children, etc. And it's a very evil thing. And we have to fight anti-Semitism at every turn. But making a joke about the Israeli government not taking care of Palestinians is not a stretch. I mean, the Palestinian people are not protected. They live in a state of inequality and injustice and oppression and occupation. And to point that out tongue in cheek, as Michael Che did, I think is actually one of the smarter jokes I've seen on TV in the last network TV in the last few years.
To be fair, and I love Michael Che, but I don't think he thought about all those things.
I am sure that Michael Che wasn't thinking about the Oslo Accords or the Fourth Geneva Convention, Article 59 or whatever. I think he was just making a really funny, provocative joke about how people get treated in Israel. Yeah. And I think that's okay.
No, and I mean, again, it's like what you said. It is about the government. Like, he was talking about the Israeli government. Like, if we were...
Yes. And let me say one more quick thing. The reason why it's also, because people say, well, yeah, but he didn't say Israelis, he said Jews or Jewish people. The issue, though, is in Israel, your nationality is not Israeli. That's by international law, it's supposed to be. But in Israel, your nationality is Jewish. You're either Jewish, Arab, Druze, or Circassian, right? So it's what's on their driver's license. Like my driver's license might say black guy, brown eyes, 5'5". I put 6'4", just, you know, for me. But like, 5'10", whatever. On theirs, it would say Arab. It would say Jew as their identity. So again, saying the Jewish half is actually talking about populations inside of Israel as the state designates it. But go ahead. I'm sorry. I just wanted to make that clear for Michael Che.
I mean, yeah, I'm sure he's listening.
I'm sure he's really, yeah, I'm sure he's real torn up about trending on Twitter. He's,
yes, yes, he didn't sleep a wink on Saturday.
He really
night.
Takes all that very personally, as you can tell.
I mean, it's the one place, especially with the most liberal or progressive people I'll meet in this country, that they don't either dare to tread or where there is a clear hypocrisy. Like, you know, I remember, especially during, you know, post 9/11, I would have really progressive people say things like, you know, what Homeland Security is doing is an invasion of personal rights, the fact that we're going to war and bombing people you don't even know, innocent people, and this isn't really targeting who did this, and war is going to lead to only more war and all this. And if you bring up Israel and Palestine, it's like, well, Israel has the right to defend itself. And it's right. Like, what just, how did you, I don't, and then it's almost like the discussion's done. It's like the same anger and the frustration you saw with your country and how we were behaving, there's this complete blind spot. Why is it that way in this country? Because it's just a thing that, I mean, even before we started this conversation, I'm like, you sure we want to start the conversation with Israel and Palestine? Maybe we could start with something lighter, like coronavirus or Texas. Right, like, right, is there something a little softer?
Right. Let's start with the 500,000 deaths.
I mean, why is it that way in this country? We are unwilling to have this discussion.
I think the ball is moving. I'm a prisoner of hope. I believe that we're entering a space where we can have smart, critical dialogues about Israel and Palestine and other things. That's why I wrote the book, Except for Palestine, The Limits of Progressive Politics, because I actually believe that while we should be critiquing where we are, as you just did, Harry, we still move so far over. I mean, if you look at the election of 2020, Bernie Sanders ran on a platform that included saying that we need to consider withholding funding to Israel based on the treatment of Palestinians in Gaza. Elizabeth Warren said the same thing. Now, they didn't win, but they didn't lose because of that. No one is saying that's the reason they lost. 20 years ago would have been the reason they lost, right? So I think there's more space for conversation. Since 2014, we've seen on the news, we've seen in everyday speech, we've seen in the films, we've just seen so much more conversation. So I'm energized by that. I don't want to advance the narrative that like we can't talk about this, because that only reinforces the secrecy. In some ways reinforces anti-Semitism, right? Because you know, we give too much power to AIPAC and too much power to the ADL, too much power to these groups to make it seem as if we can't have political victories, right? I mean, the Iran deal is a good example of a political victory. People say AIPAC's on board with the, you know, they're against the Iran deal, it'll never pass. And it passed, right? Because organized people can win a political battle. And this is a political battle. It's a battle over ideas. But to answer your question, the reason why it's been so hard to have those battles and those conversations about Israel-Palestine is for a few reasons. One is the very real, legitimate concern about the plight of Jewish people. Throughout history, Jewish people have always been subject to vulnerability, hatred, violence, racism, exclusion, etc. And when Jews have been the minority in places, they have caught hell. And so the very real fear of reinforcing that and is, you know, often prompts people to be extra careful, as I think we should be. At the same time, though, I think there are other issues at play. One issue is that in modern politics, there's been a bipartisan consensus on Israel-Palestine. And typically, if things are going the right way and it's working, you don't rock the boat. Mm-hmm. If I'm running for president and you tell me that saying Israel is my ally and we stand with Israel no matter what motivates you to change that? If your base isn't pushing you to do that and you're going to get votes for saying it, you're going to lose votes for saying the opposite, then why do you lose votes, right? And because it's so far away from you and you don't have a constituency advocating for it, it's very easy to be like, yeah, I'm not even thinking about that issue. Part of it is also a lack of education on the issue. Most of us don't know enough about this issue to have a deep investment in one side or the other. And so we repeat what we hear in the news. The other issue here is Islamophobia and anti-Arab racism. Not just anti-Arab racism, anti-brown people racism, right? Because after 9/11, Harry, people don't care whether you're Muslim but by dress, whether you're Muslim because you're brown or you're Arab, whether you're sick. You know, we saw...
Oh, Mark, I know.
Right. I was really speaking through you, you know. Like, yeah. I'm sure you experienced this. They're like, he brown. I don't care what you are. You ain't us. You ain't white.
But Hindus have been killing Muslims in India for so many generations. I don't know what that means.
Right. I mean, that's the irony of it, right? You could be like, I'm a Hindu, right? I'm from Kashmir. Like, look, like we don't even fuck with them, right? But you're still getting wrapped up. You can still get wrapped up in it.
Yeah.
And so there's a kind of indifference to what happens to Palestinians or Syrians or Bahrainis or Yemenis because we just don't care. And there's this idea, oh, they've been fighting forever. That's what those people do. It's like when black people die in Chicago. It's like, we're not that out. I mean, it's Chicago. Yeah, there were 50 deaths over the weekend in Chicago. That's fucked up. But, you know, that's what they do. Whereas if there were 50 deaths in New Trier, Illinois, or Lower Merion, Pennsylvania, we'd have a different response because it's like, oh, those people aren't supposed to be dying. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of it is that. There's an effective lobby. You know, people have the NRA has an effective lobby. You know, that's why gun control moves in the way as slowly as it does, right? It's an effective lobby. For a long time, people who are pro-lifers have an effective lobby. Palestinians do not have an effective lobby, or certainly not as effective as other groups. And so it's some of it is just it's politics as usual. So all these factors play into how we do it, and so we've just bought into the kind of normalized conversation and logic and frameworks. We say stuff like, oh, well, Israel has a right to exist. Israel has a right to defend itself. Mm-hmm. Those people have been fighting forever. Why don't we blame Hamas? They need to stop terrorism. And instead of unpacking those kinds of statements and getting somewhere better and smarter so we can have a lasting peace for everybody, we just say, we'll leave it.
And to add to your point about criticizing Israel not being anti-Semitic, there are Jews in Israel who are fighting for the rights of Palestinians. And we wouldn't accuse them, obviously, of being anti-Semitic. I mean, they're fighting for a better life for all people. And that's a difficult position for them to be in Israel. And they're doing it. And so I think to support that work, I can't imagine that being seen as anti-Semitic. And it shouldn't be.
They're often called self-hating Jews, right? Like
I was going to say.
All right, I guess there is a way to.
We got other words for that, right? They got them for black people too, but like there's for this book, which I wrote with Mitchell Plitnik, that's one of the things Mitchell gets. Mitchell was one of the founding members of Jewish Voices for Peace, you know, trying to create a lasting peace, fighting for the rights of Palestinians. And one of the things that people say to him is, you're a self-hating Jew, you're a capo, you're an enemy to your people. Mm. And sometimes even you're an anti-Semite. Peter Beinart has been called the same thing. And it's very, very sad because, you know, many of us just want justice, right? And we don't want justice to come at the expense of someone else. I want peace for everybody. I want Jewish people to be safe and peaceful and have self-determination and dignity, just like everybody else.
Part of this, the problem with the discussion, especially when you come from the left perspective or progressive perspective, is that, as you said, the conversation is so charged. And even years ago, I did an event at the San Francisco Jewish Community Center. And at the at the event, I decided to bring in some pro-Palestinian Jews to talk to some pro-Israel Jews to have a conversation in the San Francisco Jewish Community Center. And even the want to have the conversation sent off a whole, like, sort of a bunch of emails went back and forth. They hired extra security. Mm-hmm. There was this real sense of, like, that it was dangerous to have that conversation in a Jewish community center. And I thought, and certainly I'm from the outside, but I was like, that's a problem with trying to get into this conversation. Even having it, you're told, this could lead to danger.
And that's why most people stay away from it. People say, you know what, don't even talk about it. You know, when this book came out, it's been out for a week now, except for Palestine, there are a lot of publications that said, you know, we'd rather not deal with it. And let me be clear, it's not some Jewish conspiracy. It's not a lobby that's trying to undermine this book. It's not a cabal of power. It's that publishing houses just don't want controversy. And they know that this is a controversial issue and not the kind of controversial issue that brings like a lot of readership in, but it kind of brings protests in. It's unfortunate because I think there's such an opportunity with this issue to not just be an issue about Israelis and Palestinians, but to be a referendum on a bigger conversation about what justice might look like and how it might feel. And that, for me, is super interesting.
The thing you said earlier, which I understand why the need to say that, but for me, about not just wanting to say it's a one-to-one comparison between white and Jewish and black and Palestinian, but yeah. For me, years ago, through a friend, Jennifer Jaje, who's a Palestinian-American, that's how I sort of started to go, oh, I get it now. Like, you know, obviously It's not the same, but when you sort of hear about the power dynamics, you hear about about the living conditions. You hear about like the lack of accessibility to healthcare, all these things. You go, oh, I get it now. That for me, that was a great way to frame it. Didn't mean I was able to have the conversation. I was still afraid of the conversation, but I understood it in a different way. And so much of this, the reason why we're not having the conversation in the country, to me, is like a complete lack of education in our school system about the Middle East in general, about that area of the world, where it's just about the war. It's not about who's living there and what's going on.
I think it's helpful to talk about how Palestinians are racialized and how being Palestinian is the thing that makes you vulnerable, as a scholar, Ruth Wilson Gilmore, said, being vulnerable to premature death. Just like in the United States, being Black makes you more likely to get COVID, makes you less likely to get a job, makes you more, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Being Palestinian anywhere, whether it's inside of Israel, whether it's in the occupied territories, whether it's in Gaza, whether it's in exile, being Palestinian makes you more likely to be vulnerable to premature death. And so those are, I would make a comparison to that extent. Other than that, maybe it's the academic. I'm just always anxious about and uneasy with comparisons. Yeah. But you're right. I mean, but that is a helpful framework. And when I have been in the region, and when other people, when we've even led delegations in the region, that's the first thing people do, especially Black people. I remember being at IDALA, which is a justice organization in Haifa, in northern Israel. And they were talking to us and they said, yo, there was this Palestinian kid. He's a citizen of Israel. This Palestinian kid who got shot by the police. The police said that he ran at them with a knife. A couple months later, they found videotape and you could see that they shot the kid and then dragged his body closer to the camera and put a knife in his hand. They said, could you believe that? And all the Black people in the room was like, yeah. Believe it. Yeah. I sent it. You know, So that's the kind of so in that sense, there are ways that state violence and racialization and beauty standards, all these things do play into it. Right. So there's lots of levels to this.
Trump and Netanyahu were very close. Obama was a lot less friendly with Netanyahu, but that didn't mean that there was substantial progress for Palestinians. What have you seen from the Biden administration so far? Are they going to do anything differently? And what kind of pressure do people need to put on the administration? What kind of things should be asked for?
I've seen nothing from the Biden administration to make me feel that anything's going to change. It doesn't mean that Biden and Trump are the same. It just means that on this issue, doing nothing is often seen as best case scenario. We don't imagine beyond that. I'll give you an example. Donald Trump moved the American embassy from Tel Aviv, where it had been, to Jerusalem. There are like two embassies in Jerusalem. Everybody else in the world keeps it in Tel Aviv. Why? Because Jerusalem is contested. And ultimately, when there's a resolution to this conflict, the status of Jerusalem will be one of the, what we call a final status issue, will be one of the things that's decided upon in the end. And so by saying that we're putting our embassy there, we're recognizing Jerusalem as all of Jerusalem as Israel's, right? That goes against international law. That goes against precedent. And it's seen as putting your thumb on the scale to something that's not resolved. So Trump did that. He moved the embassy, right? And again, like almost no one has done that. And no one, even people who said they're going to do it, haven't really done it. So in that moment, you say, well, look, Trump's a monster. He just broke decades of international law and precedent. This is another example of Trump just operating on his own, doing his own thing. I get you. And there is some truth to that. But the Jerusalem Embassy Act was actually signed in 1995. That's when Bill Clinton was president. And it was signed in October of 95. And Bill Clinton did it because he wanted to show that he could be tough on Palestinians, too, because that's how you get elected, right? To show that you can be tough on Palestinians, too. And so the Congress put the bill forward. Bill Clinton, he's a smooth operator. He didn't sign the bill, but he didn't veto it, right? He let it pass. Nobody wanted to move the embassy. They just wanted to be able to show the lobby that they could do it. And because the right was like, what you going to do about Jerusalem? Every president be like, Jerusalem is Israel's. That's cool. But then they just don't do nothing about it. But they call Clinton's bluff and they call the Democrats and the Congress's bluff. So what they do, they made a bill. But in the bill, they have a what they call a waiver, which means that every 6 months you can sign the waiver and then we don't have to actually move the embassy yet. So from 1995 until like 2 years ago, almost 3 years ago now, 2018, June, May of 2018, every president, Democrat and Republican, has just signed a waiver every 6 months. Mm. So technically, America has already moved the embassy. We just keep signing the waiver, saying not yet, not yet, not yet. Trump is like, it's like that first person in history that actually called Columbia House and said, you know what, I want to cancel my subscription. Like,
hold up, wait a minute.
Well, kids, let's talk about Columbia House. Columbia House was Columbia Records' umbrella brand for its mail-order music clubs. Yes, I said mail-order music. It was established in 1955, and it became a big deal. You have no idea how big. From the 1970s through the 1990s, going from vinyl to 8-tracks, cassettes, and finally CDs. Columbia House and other music clubs, such as Hurdy's favorite, the BMG Music Club, peaked in 1994, accounting for 15.1% of all CD sales.
I mean, it seemed amazing at the time. They'd send you mail advertising records you could basically get for free. And they'd say things like, 8 CDs for a penny. And you're like, this is incredible. How on earth is this possible? All you have to do is promise to buy a number of records at full retail price. The thing is, and you'd wonder, like, how are they possibly making money? They're basically basing their model on people being lazy and forgetful and not canceling after meeting their minimal obligation. So 8 CDs for a penny all of a sudden becomes 8 CDs for hundreds of dollars. And look, I like Toad the Wet Sprocket, but I really didn't need the full album. Next thing you know, your parents are like, why am I sending $150 to BMG?
Not only were they charging you full retail price for the CDs, but after you factored in shipping, it was often way more expensive than buying it down the street.
This shitty business practice was called negative option billing, and it's now banned in 15 states as well as most of the provinces in Canada.
Some people scammed the record clubs right back. In March 2000, 60-year-old Joseph Parvin admitted that he had used 16 post office boxes and his own home address to scam Columbia House and BMG out of, wait for it, 26,554 discs during a 5-year span in the 90s. He pleaded guilty to a single count of mail fraud.
Side note, apparently 3 million of the 13 million copies sold of Hootie and the Blowfish's Cracked Rear View were sold this way.
This is the kind of capitalism that America invents.
Yeah.
Like, this is how we do capitalism here. Is there a way to take advantage of people? Oh, let's do that kind of capitalism. One person at a
time. And so Trump isn't really out of step with American policy. He's just being honest about it. And so now that it's moved, Biden is like, well, yeah, we got an embassy. And it's moved. He said, I'm not moving it back. It's too much trouble to move it back. It's not too much trouble to move it back. It would take like one phone call to move it back. But Biden knows that moving the embassy back would be looking like he's defending Palestinians. So he's going to do nothing because that's the safe political bet. It's not that Biden gives a shit about where the embassy is per se, but moving it is too much trouble. Not doing anything is a safe place. So that's what he's going to do. And that's how the Biden presidency is going to play out for every single issue. The one thing Biden did do, and this is the lowest of low-hanging fruit, was that he gave money back to UNRWA, the United Nations Relief Works Agency. UNRWA is basically the agency that takes care of refugees, takes care of Palestinians in the West Bank. Trump cut it all so they could get no food, no clothing, no shelter, no education. It was like the cruelest act. I mean, you think kids in cages is bad? This is like, they're on the same tier. You know what I'm saying? Biden said, okay, basically, like, we'll take the kids out the cages. He said, we'll allow Palestinians to eat and sleep again, right? That's all he did. And even that, he had to kind of explain why. So I don't expect any movement on this. I expect the movement to come when we demand more from politicians.
You brought up earlier the cable news network that you formerly worked for.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember the moment that you got let go from that cable news network that I also currently work for. I'm mostly on a temp, though. I'm not a full-time employee, just to be clear. seasonal worker. Looking back on that, and I'm sure, was that a part of the impetus to write the book, like just how that all went down? Is there anything you look back on that and go, I mean, I remember there was a focus on the word you said specifically that, again, as someone who's not an expert in that, I didn't know what that meant or read it that way, and certainly know you to be a good person and believe in you want peace for all people and equity for all people. Was that a part of what led you to write the book? When you look back on that, would you have done it differently?
I started writing this book before that speech. Mitchell and I have been working on the book. We've been talking about it, and we've been working on it for a few, we've been talking about it since the beginning of that year. And we had just started to make a proposal and write it out. Clearly I didn't expect that speech to get, to get the response that it got. But no, I had a whole different idea about it. I wrote that speech. I don't ever write speeches. I typically kind of freestyle, do it off the cuff. You know, I have ideas and I map them out. But I've been traveling. I was actually been in Palestine for a couple of weeks, and I flew back just to give this speech. And I was very tired. And I was like, it's the United Nations, you know, I got to wear a tie. You know, I should probably like have my speech organized. And I said, you know, I'm going to write this one just so nothing controversial happens. So I wrote every word of that speech, except maybe like the last page, right? Which is probably where I went wrong. That seems to be where things freestyle. But I wrote it, and I was so carefully trying to compare and weave in the Declaration of International Declaration of Human Rights, international law. I had all my I's dotted and T's crossed. I thought that I gave an effective speech and a persuasive one. And judging from the fact that people only focus on the last 6 or 8 words suggests that I was probably right, because everyone who disagrees with me, they don't disagree with the content of the speech. There hasn't been one piece written on the content of the speech. It's just on those eight words. The question is always asked, you know, to me, like, if you could say those 8 words again, would you delete those 8 words? And give a difference, you know, what would you do it differently if you knew going in what the response was going to be? And that becomes kind of a philosophical question, you know, that I somewhat avoid for a few reasons, but because I'm not sure it's the point, but ultimately I think a lot of people who were critiquing me in bad faith. So I don't believe that those 8 words would have changed anything. If I could have effectively given that speech and kept the job at CNN, sure, I would love to do that. I like working. I like eating every day, you know, but, you know, I also want to keep my principles. And I truly believe, truly, that what I said, in fact, I know it's not a belief thing. I know that what I said was in good faith and with good intent. And I know that I as someone who's fought for and fought with my Jewish brothers and sisters since I've been a teenager, I want nothing more than safety, dignity, freedom, justice, and self-determination for them. Just like I want for Palestinian people. The reason why I fight on behalf of Palestinians is because I believe that the Israeli government, just like many other governments, the United States government, the Saudi government, the French government, we're going down the list, the Egyptian government has flaws, deeply rooted flaws that need to be critiqued and challenged so that we can produce more justice for everybody.
Is there anything that you recommend people can do who want to obviously buy the book? We will be promoting the book to help out with this discussion, or any way that you would, other resources you would say people can educate themselves, or is there anything people can actually do to help out here?
I tell people, you know, read up on the issue as much as possible. There's a lot of books that people should read. Mine is a good book, but it's not where you start. If you go to UncleBobby's.com, we have a whole list of books on the subject that you can explore. You can get different takes, different points of view. If you want to do something, I tell people donate to Playgrounds for Palestine. If you want to donate to something on this issue, no matter where you land on this issue, I hope you believe that children deserve joy and protection and innocence. I was in a town in Rahat, which is in the Naqab, or the southern region of Israel, the Negev, and kids hadn't had a playground or a yard there since 1947. And so, you know, donating to Playgrounds for Palestine is, I think, a wonderful way to contribute to alleviating the suffering that's going on in the world and making a difference on this very issue.
I just want to segue right now to Texas, what's happening in Texas. Yeah. I realize, you know, a lot of people, when they talk about what's happening in Texas, they can bring up climate change as the reason why so many people are dying right now, not used to this kind of weather, not used to snow. The governments were not prepared for this. But I think it's also important.
Ted Cruz was.
Well, yeah, he was.
He had Expedia.com ready.
Oh, his kids weren't, though. His kids didn't, like, Daddy, did you just throw me under the bus?
Yes.
But, you know, I think what's left out of the discussion often is the role that capitalism and specifically privatization of basic resources has had in the suffering of people in Texas right now. So I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, no, it's a great point you raise. And I talk about this a little bit. I'm not trying to sell books here today, but in my book, Nobody.
No, first of all, We are trying to sell books. Let's not do that.
I guess what I mean is, I really do think the book is relevant. Some people just be working a book in, even if it's not relevant. Yeah. You know, like speaking of climate change, this book I wrote on yoga is a really perfect. You know, like, I want to do one of them. But I wrote a book called Nobody a few years ago, from Ferguson to Flint, Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable, from Ferguson to Flint and beyond. And I talk about Flint water crisis. And there's like the question of race and racism sometimes, or gender, or whatever the thing might be on this particular issue. But oftentimes the question around capitalism and the question around privatization and neoliberal economies don't come in as much. And that's why I'm glad you asked that question, because it's not just that there are climate change deniers out there, right? Who were led by a president who for years not only was stubborn on the issue and arrogant on the issue, but unsurprisingly, uneducated on the issue. He'd be like, oh, they're saying there's climate change, you know, but look how cold it is. Look up at the snow. It's like, there's no global warming. There's snow outside. It's like, that's not what this means. So there's that. But there's also the privatization of resources. You're absolutely right. One of the worst things that has happened over the last 20 years or 30 years even has been the move toward what, you know, we academics often refer to as neoliberalism, right? Which is the liberalization of the market. We've decided that the market, that buying and selling things, that privatizing things, that being more quote unquote efficient, that austerity, that all these things are the best way to make government work. So the private good has trumped, no pun intended, the public interest. So you see more and more privatized school, you see privatized police force, privatized public defender's offices, privatizing of natural and public resources. And all of these moves make it much more difficult to respond to public crisis, because the ultimate question now is not how many people are helped, but how much money can we make or how much money can we save? And so when money becomes the ultimate decider and not justice or fairness or ethics or morality, then you end up in situations like Texas where, of course, climate change is an issue. Of course, it being 10 degrees in Dallas is going to throw everybody off in Dallas because they don't have the resources to respond to this. But then you have companies who have hedged their bets, right, on a certain kind of outcome or a certain kind of arrangement in Texas in terms of heating, in terms of public works, in terms of who brings out the salt plows when it snows. All these things that, you know, obviously we don't need very often, right? And people aren't willing to lose money in order to produce more equitable outcomes. It'll be like, oh, let them freeze for a couple of weeks. It'll work itself out. Oh, let them do this for a couple of weeks. Or in Flint, the water will clean itself up, right? Yeah, it's green. And yeah, kids are getting Legionnaires' disease, but we'll figure it out. God forbid we spend more money. And so that's where we're seeing in Texas. And then when you combine that with really bad leadership, and bad, not just in the sense that I don't agree with them or I don't like their approach to solving the problem, but I mean a real nuts and bolts, like Ted Cruz goes to a resort while people are dying and freezing and desperate, a kind of callousness, a kind of cynicism about the people that I think makes it impossible to get their confidence or to get good outcomes.
You know, and we talk about this in the midst of this all happening in the midst of a pandemic. First of all, I just want to be clear. Our thoughts and prayers are with you and your family with the passing of your father and your sister. Yes.
Thank you.
I know you had COVID earlier during the pandemic. COVID is hitting the Black community hard, and it's also hitting us in a way where we were already being hit, as you talked about so eloquently, by neoliberalism and capitalism. And right now there's this thing where we have to figure out, these vaccines are out, where now we're finding out we're not getting vaccinated at the levels that that white folks are getting vaccinated at. And Black folks, for reasons we can go into, are suspicious of the vaccine, for reasons that are not our faults. I would like to be clear about that, right? That, you know, America earned our suspicion over its entire history and before the history of this country.
Facts.
What are your thoughts on any of that?
You know, I got vaccinated. I got my second shot a week ago. I'm waiting on another week so that I can my whole body can be, you know, fully vaccinated. I ain't gonna act a fool. You know, I'm still gonna wear a mask. I'm still gonna, you know, I mean, I'll be a little, you know, I'm gonna be the same, because I want to send a public message. You know what I mean? That masks are cool and necessary. But I remember being in line. I went to an initiative that was, and just so people know, I didn't jump the line. I didn't skip the line. I got it fairly and appropriately. But there was an initiative in Philadelphia by one organization that was trying to get Black folk the vaccine. And one time I went to get the vaccine and there was maybe 500 people wrapped around North Philly. I mean like North Philly, not like Temple University, North Philly, not gentrified North Philly, like where you go to buy heroin, where you go to buy crack, you know, North Philly. And there were maybe 400 people in line. And of the 400 people in line, maybe 60 were black.
Wow.
There were people in that line who clearly, I mean, and these weren't like, because there's white Philadelphians too in North Philly, you know, but this wasn't like Kensington, poor white folk. This was like people with Birkenstocks, you know, remember it was like 30 degrees outside. These like shorts and hood and Swarthmore College hoodies. You know, these were people who had cracked the code to get in there. And there's a couple things there. One, the suburban white folk found ways to access these resources. And two, there were black folk who legitimately were afraid to get it.
Yeah.
On the one hand, like you said, and Kamal, I think you hit it 100% on the head. Like, we have to look at the reasons why black people are skeptical. And that's why I think it's important for our leaders to get these things. You know, people said the NBA shouldn't jump the line. I don't want the NBA to jump the line because I want Joel Embiid to win the MVP. But I do wonder what it means for people who we look up to and admire and respect to get the vaccine so that people say, well, shit, if you know what I mean? If LeBron's getting it, then maybe it's good enough for me. I think we have to look at the years of any, like you said, inequality, the damage that's been done in our community, the reason why we're skeptical of the medical establishment in general. I think all of that matters. But I also think we have to look at how resources are being distributed in these cities. In Philadelphia, and that's the only, I haven't studied this issue beyond my city, because it's, but in Philadelphia, all of the vaccine initiatives, the one major one was led by a group of white 20-somethings, and they just weren't doing good. The community wasn't feeling reached out to. And then this other initiative was under, which was led by a black doctor, Ayla Stanford, was under-resourced at first. You got 500 people in line and 100 vaccines. What are you going to do? And so we finally convinced the city to give her more resources. But as soon as it hit that they got the more resources, they made a public website because you can't say only black people can get this. And then the white folk jumped on the website, got all the appointments. You see what I'm saying? And the next thing you know, you know, the black church has a line filled with white people to get the vaccine. And so it's all those factors together that we need to be really intentional about resolving. But I want folk to get the vaccine as soon as possible. But I also want folk to engage in social distancing, wear masks, and do all the things so that hopefully within the next 12 months, 14 months, whatever, we're still okay. We're where we want to be. I won't say back to normal, but where we want to be.
Mark, Joel Embiid isn't winning the MVP. I heard everything you said, and I agree with everything except that one point.
He's where not, are you he's from? Not are, you, are you a Laker fan? You must be a Lakers fan.
No, he's a New York Knicks fan.
Wait, you're a New York. Okay, sir. If you're a New York Knicks fan, you're not qualified to be part of a conversation on basketball MVPs. When was the last MVP that came out of New York? What was it? Willis Reed?
Well, maybe it might be Richie Guerin back in the 1940s.
Might be Richie Guerin in 1940s, like four or something like that. And New York, I didn't even know they still had basketball in New York. I knew they had Brooklyn, the Brooklyn Nets, but I didn't even know the Knicks still played basketball. I mean, like,
they signed a lease with the Garden. They still got to play. We're having Miro from Deez and Miro on the podcast soon, so we'll have the other side of this discussion with someone on my side of it. So.
That's fair. And again, we'll know soon enough. We'll know in 3 months.
Okay.
We have to bring you back no matter what happens, just because I would like to see the more. I'd like to listen to this podcast some more.
Mark, thank you so much for being on the podcast. This was really fun. Thank you. It was a hard pleasure, conversation, man. And it was a good conversation.
No, you're right. Whenever you talk Sixers, it's a hard conversation. This is your Palestine shit, too, but when you talk Sixers basketball, man, you know. No, thank you, guys. Really, I appreciate the time and the space.
Sure. Thank you.
All right, peace.
Mark Lamont Hill is an academic, activist, and journalist. His latest book is Except for Palestine, The Limits of Progressive Politics.
Mark also hosts a podcast called Coffee and Books, which refers to Uncle Bobby's, the cafe and bookstore he owns in his hometown of Philadelphia, where he's also director of the People's Education Center.
When we come back, we're going to talk to my mom about her experience getting the COVID-19 vaccine, or as he calls her, Janet.
J. Janet Cheatham Bell is an independent scholar and author. She's written a number of books, including Famous Black Quotations for the 21st Century, which will be published this fall.
She is also my mom and my daughter's grandmother, and she recently got the COVID-19 vaccine. And I wanted to get her on the show to talk about the experience.
Let's talk to Kamau's mom. Janet, Kamau asked me to ask the first question, so I'm going to start with, how are you?
I am great.
Well, what have you been up to?
I'm actually working on a new book of famous Black quotations.
Oh.
The last one came out in 95, and I think a few things have happened since then.
And just for the listeners, she means 1995, not 1895.
Kamau. Kamau. Please. I'm sorry, Janet.
Thank you, Hari. Thank you very much.
I have a feeling that one W. Kamau Bell will not be in this book of quotations. You lost your chance.
I am. Yeah. Well, that has changed since 1995 when it came out. I have become a more famous Black, so it's possible I could be in here somewhere. The interesting thing about you living in Oakland, connected to what we're talking about, is me and Melissa were always planning on moving you out here. She understood from early on when we started dating and got married that you came with the program. And someone was like, at some point, she's going to have to live in our house or very close to our house. So she was always accepted that. But we moved you out earlier than we thought due to basically wanting to be able to take care of you and see your health care better than it was happening in Indiana, right?
Yes. Yes, because the health care in Indiana is not the best. As a matter of fact, for my annual checkups, they stopped even letting me see a nurse practitioner. They would never let me see a doctor. But then they wouldn't even let me see a nurse practitioner anymore because I didn't have any health problems. So they told me I had to see a pharmacist.
And I was like, pharmacist?
Yeah, I'm not kidding. A pharmacist. And I was like, why would I see a pharmacist? Well, they can help you go through your drugs and find out if you're taking all the right things. But I don't take any drugs. So then when I was diagnosed with malignancy in my gum, and they said it needed to be taken care of right away, and I tried to make an appointment with the person they referred me to, and he said he couldn't see me for 2 months. So that was when Kamau said, Ma, you've got to take care of this in California.
And I mean, I just want to be clear, the reason why I think it's important to talk about this, we're here to talk about your vaccine, but you are a person who knows the ins and outs of America's racist healthcare system.
Yes.
You have dealt with the blunt end of America's racist healthcare system as recently as just a few years ago when this happened. And really the thing I knew is that you had a malignancy in your jaw, and I just happened to know a guy who does dental surgery out here. And I talked to him about it. He's like, oh, no. Like, he was just like, don't let her sit there. And I know a guy, we'll get her in. And so even me, somebody who has quote unquote levels of privilege and blah, 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 happened to know the right person who could help us get into the place we need to get into. I'm not saying we couldn't have got in otherwise, but it certainly helped to know the right people. So that's not how healthcare should work, is being lucky enough to have a son who's on TV who knows the right people.
No, it shouldn't. Healthcare should be a right, not a happenstance privilege. But in this country, it's a business.
You've said this before, you're 83 years old.
Yes.
So many people who are at that age are on several different medications. Your son, who is not 83 years old, is on several different medications. So, like, it becomes quite remarkable to them the fact that you're not on a bunch of different medications.
Yeah. I think they're offended by it, really. Because, you know, how can the pharmaceutical industry make money if everybody's not on a bunch of different medications?
Ooh, all right. Can we talk a little bit about, and I know this because I know you, but what your experience has been of during COVID and how you've taken care of yourself?
During COVID, I have, first of all, regular visits with my granddaughters, because being around them keeps my spirits up, because they are so present in the moment and always find ways to keep busy and be amusing and be amused. And so that always makes me feel better.
But there was that part at the beginning where we sort of weren't sure early on, back when we were all, well, not all of us, but many of us were washing our groceries and really afraid that if I touch the wrong, you know, if I walk outside and touch a tree, I'm going to get COVID from the last person who had COVID who touched the tree. And, you know, we, just because we were all nervous about it. Yeah. And there was a few weeks where I remember we just drove past you one time and slowed down the car and everybody had masks on and we sort of waved at you. And then, you know, there was really a point where,
drive-by visit,
And then there was a point where we were having visits outside near where you lived.
Yeah.
But again, we were trying to maintain social distance. And so, and the girls were, you know, the girls were pretty good about it, but we had to remind them and we still weren't giving you hugs. And, you know, we were all wearing masks. And it was only, you know, over time as we learned more about COVID that I feel like we finally had the moment where, like, okay, because the girls would be like, can we hug Gogo?
I had repressed all of that early part, Kamau.
Yeah, no, I know. I just wanted to remind you, not that we're going back there, but remind you that there was that you did. I think we all took it very seriously, but you took it very seriously, and so you would for a while you didn't see your grandkids. Yeah,
yeah, I definitely did not want to get COVID for sure. I didn't want to have to go anywhere near any kind of healthcare facility, so I was being very, very careful.
So can you talk about how did it feel when you heard about COVID? Were you suspicious? Because this whole conversation is really about how some Black people are suspicious of anything they hear from the government. Some Black people are suspicious of anything they hear from the healthcare industry. And we've talked about this before. I argue rightfully so. I understand why that would be the case. But not that I think that they, not that I believe all the suspicion, but I understand why Black people would hold suspicion around the government and the healthcare industry. Where do you fall in that?
I definitely am suspicious of the government and the healthcare industry. Definitely, yes. I mean, because I have seen way too much systemic racism in both. However, hearing the numbers of people who were getting sick and dying convinced me to be careful.
And when you heard that the vaccine had happened and that they were starting to hand them out, what were your thoughts around getting a vaccine?
Well, I was skeptical at first because, first of all, I don't like having pharmaceuticals in my body, period, as you know, Kamau.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and,
yes.
And as a matter of fact, I had never had a flu shot before Asha was born.
And we were told if you want to see your
that if you want to see your new granddaughter, you have to have a flu shot. So I got a flu shot. So, but when the vaccine came along, I was willing to do that simply because I'm up to my eyeballs with the pandemic. I want it to be over, and if getting a vaccination will help it to be over, I'm ready to get a vaccination, and so I did.
When you went to get vaccinated, how diverse was the line of people getting vaccinated? Were there lots of people of color, or was it mostly white?
It was mostly white because I got vaccinated in San Francisco.
Yeah, that'll happen.
However, there were some people of color there as well.
Yeah.
I wasn't the only one.
And I want to be clear, the fact that she got vaccinated in San Francisco is sort of about the fact that because we had lived there at a certain point, you were, I think, in the system at UCSF?
Yeah, I was. Yeah.
But, and this is the thing that's frustrating. A few days out, before your vaccination, I sort of had this point of hitting a wall, like, wait, I'm starting to hear about older people getting vaccinated, but you hadn't been vaccinated yet. And I sort of had this freak out. And me and Melissa, like, she found a website called Vaccinate California where you can figure out how to sign up for vaccinations. But then a lot of them, they will only sign you up if you're an existing customer, which is the best way to put it, in their healthcare system. And so we were trying to figure out how to navigate. And then we, you know.
I had signed up in the Alameda County healthcare system where they said, you know, register so that when the vaccine is ready, you can get vaccinated. And I had signed up there before you and Melissa started getting hysterical.
Alameda County is where Oakland is. It's where a lot of Black and brown folks live. It is, you know, it certainly does not have the tax base that San Francisco has. It's not as white as San Francisco. And only because I think you were already in the system at UCSF, did you get a call from UCSF. But if you were just a black person living in Alameda County who had been born and raised here, you might still be waiting on your vaccination.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Which means there's a lot of older black folks who are probably not getting their vaccines. I mean, I think a lot of this is about sort of the inherent structural racism of the healthcare industry, that the ways in which you get vaccines is by not only being able to get on the internet, which is one challenge, but also being able to navigate the internet and not being intimidated by like a website that goes, here's the 15 different ways you can do this. 8 of them don't work. 6 of them, you'll start to work and then they won't work. And then maybe one of them is the one that you will actually be able to. And that's a lot. That's a lot to put people through who are maybe just like, I'm still trying to figure out Zoom.
Yeah, I had to sign up for UCSF online, and the appointment verification and all of that had to be done online. But I noticed in San Francisco that the San Francisco General Hospital, because they finally got the message that a lot of people can't operate online, they just had, you know, first come, first serve vaccinations.
I mean, it's almost like the people running this have no idea what it might be like to be an older person, and the fact that, you know, I'll use my parents. My father is tech savvy enough. My mother, like, tells me her computer is broken, which just means she can't remember her password for Google or doesn't know how to get to Gmail. So it just feels like, you know, if older people were supposed to get the vaccine first, it's supposed to be set up for them to get it first, then make it easier for them to get it.
And let's be clear, this is where the distrust comes from. And yeah. Is that the fact is like the system says, come get your vaccine, but then puts a bunch of things in front of you to get the vaccine. And it feels like the system's saying, we don't mean you. We don't mean, you know, so which then creates trust about like, well, why don't you want me to have it? Or why is this so hard? Or maybe it's not real. Like, I think this is sort of feeds into the distrust that America has earned from black folks, indigenous folks, and people of color. You know, which is why I think it's important for someone like you, Ma, who is suspicious of the healthcare industry, who has dealt with, as I've said before, all of America's racism except for enslavement, basically, that to you to say, I am that person and I got the vaccine.
I want to stop the spread of COVID desperately. I want to be able to meet my friends and have dinner at a restaurant.
Oh, now slow down. Now you sound like Meghan McCain. I want to be able to go bar hopping. But, you know, but even so, as we've talked about, do you think you'll still be, once you get, now that you got the vaccine, I've seen you're still wearing your mask. You're not walking. You're not out here like a teenager on spring break.
No. I'm going to continue to wear my mask even after I get my second shot. Because I know everybody hasn't gotten vaccinated yet. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I don't expect my behavior to change at all once I get my second shot.
What do you mean?
Well, I've been thinking about this, as a matter of fact, whether or not I can, after I get my second shot, can I go grocery shopping? Because, you know, I haven't been doing that. Mm. And I would like to go pick out my own groceries. So I've been running this around in my head. If I get the second shot and put my mask on, maybe 2 masks on, mm-hmm. Can I go grocery shopping?
That's your big goal.
Not
a Cancun vacation, grocery shopping?
Yeah, grocery shopping, yes.
Do you have any friends who are leery about getting the vaccine?
I have friends who have told me they're not getting it.
Wow.
Yeah. And one of them is someone who has other, what'd they say?
Comorbidities?
Yes. But she says she's not getting it. And I did not argue with her.
Are the reasons historic and, you know, kind of what we discussed in terms of the experience a lot of black people have had with both the government and with, you know, the medical testing? Or is it also just not knowing how good these vaccines are at this point so early on?
Because of the fact that she has definitely, you know, seen doctors for other purposes, I think is that she doesn't trust the vaccine. She feels like it was too quickly developed and that she's not going to risk it. She feels like it's risky.
So she's just waiting to see what happens to the first.
I guess she's waiting to see what happens to me, and then if I don't, if so I live through it, she might consider getting it, maybe.
And you don't feel the need to talk your friends out of this if they say they're not going to get a vaccine?
No. Mm-mm. No, because my friends are all either as old as I am or very close to it. And when people are at that age, unless they have a son like Kamal, you can't talk them into anything.
What are you trying to say about me?
Kamal just wears you down. You know, he just keeps coming.
Thank God you're here. My God, Janet, you have no idea how long I've held on to that. I am so happy you're here.
He just won't stop reminding you to take care of yourself and to be healthy and to take good medical advice. He won't stop. He's just relentless in his care for you. The last thing I want to talk to you about is just a little bit about, because you shared this story with me, and I think it's a powerful story about black folks and racism and the healthcare industry, is about, and also comes out of Indiana, is Dr. Susan Moore.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was such a sad case. This black woman, who is a physician herself, started recognizing that she was feeling some symptoms of COVID and went to the hospital. And they dismissed her, you know, saying that, no, you know, it wasn't anything serious, you know, take an aspirin and go to bed. And so she went back home, but she started feeling worse and went back. And this time she insisted that they, you know, test her. And sure enough, she had COVID. But by then it had reached an advanced stage and they weren't, you know, taking her seriously or giving her the treatment she needed. And she eventually died. But before she died, she did a video on Facebook from her hospital bed talking about the poor treatment she received, even though she's a physician.
Wow.
And knew what was happening. Still, they wouldn't take her seriously. After she had died and all of this went viral, they tried to pretend that she had intimidated the nurses because she was a doctor. Like, nurses aren't accustomed to dealing with doctors.
And she's a black woman in Indiana, in the Indiana healthcare system, the same one you were in.
The same healthcare system that told me I couldn't see a doctor. I'm very grateful for the fact that I was not still living in Indiana when the pandemic hit, because otherwise I'd probably be dead by now myself.
And just to be clear, Hari, my mom speaks like that every few days about ways in which she would be dead, so no need to take that too seriously.
No, I was trying to figure out, like, come on, we can't end the interview this way. I don't know what to say at this point. It's going to be hard to get us out of this. You know?
Had a segue, had to come up with a rappy repartee to end up with, I would be dead by now. I mean... So what do you say to black folks who are worried about getting this vaccine? A lot of them aren't 83. A lot of them are younger. They're in their 20s and 30s. About, what do you say to those folks?
Well, I think that because this COVID is so contagious, we have to protect ourselves and each other because we're all connected. I mean, do we want to spend the rest of our lives social distancing and wearing masks? I don't. And this is the only way to get out of it, is to get everybody vaccinated. So I want to go back to living fully, wholeheartedly. I love my family, but I'd like to see some friends from time to time.
Well, that tells you everything you know you need to about my mom. I mean, I like my son and his wife and their kids, but I don't only like them.
Yeah. So I recommend it. I really do.
Well, thank you, Mom, for coming on the show to talk about this. Thanks, we appreciate
Janet. It. Well, thank you for having me.
Janet Cheatham Bell is an independent author and scholar.
She's also my mom, but she doesn't care what you take out of any of this as long as you go to her website, janetcheathambell.com, and buy some of her many books that she has published, janetcheathambell.com.
Her next book, Famous Black Quotations for the 21st Century, will be published this fall.
That's it for this week. Thanks to Mark Lamont Hill, and thanks to my mom, Janet Cheatham Bell.
We always want to hear what you think about the conversations we're having on Politically Reactive.
Leave us a voicemail at 917-477-6525.
That's 917-477-6525.
And keep your comments and questions coming on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram with the hashtag Politically Reactive.
And please rate and review the show wherever you get your podcast. It does spread the word and help people discover the show.
And as always, do the things that we've asked you to do throughout the show. So as Mark Lamont Hill said, you can go to the website playgroundsforpalestine.org. Playgroundsforpalestine.org. And also, once again, my mom's website, janetcheathambell.com. I'm a good son. At the end of the credits, you always hear me thank Brontez Purnell for the music on the show. In addition to being an incredible musician, Brontez is also a dancer, a director, and a writer. And this month he's out with a new novel that's getting a lot of buzz. It's called 100 Boyfriends. And also he has a new 3-song EP out called White Boy Music.
And as always, Kamau and I have Netflix specials, and you should watch them because they're really underappreciated.
I actually saw that Netflix put on YouTube one of my bits from my Netflix special about Doc McStuffins. I guess for Black History Month anyway. Thanks a lot, Netflix. Politically Reactive is a production of Topic Studios and Warner Media Podcast Network. Executive producers are Maria Zuckerman and Christy Gressman.
And W. Kamau Bell.
And the Honorable Hari Kondabolu.
The show is produced by Matt Martin, Malachi Seeger, Sakir, and Kelly Rafferty. Will Stanton engineers and mixes the show.
And thanks, as always, to Brontez Purnell for providing music for the show. Thanks for listening to Politically Reactive.
Stay tuned. There's a fun part coming up. Everything you're saying is true, and I will not disagree with you, but Joel Embiid is not winning the MVP.
That was such a Fox News, like, MAGA answer. He's like, I understand everything you said. I heard all of your facts. I heard all of your data, but you know what? I'm keeping my baby. Like what? Yeah.
We're going to commercial.
Right.
There are LeBron, there's Giannis, there's too many people on winning teams.
I want to give you a 30-second reason why that's ridiculous.
Okay.
And then once he wins the MVP, I want you to invite me back, and I want a full-throated apology.
Fair. Ooh, fair. Ooh, that's fair. That's fair.
I'm a Knicks fan, so I have no issues with eating crow. So
I was going to say shame, dignity, all those things.
Yeah. So
Joel Embiid, PER is the most advanced statistical measure of player effectiveness.
I love
right?
that we're starting with like
an academics. Go start with the numbers.
Yes, I'm an academic.
Also, you said you weren't a basketball expert. Now you're talking
about PER. I'm not a basketball expert.
PER,
I just know a lot about it. So. PER is the most advanced register of player efficiency, right? It came around about 10 years, 15 years ago. It counts your points, your rebounds, your assists, everything offensive, right? The highest PER rate is typically correlated to the person who wins the MVP. So you can't be lower than 2 or 3 in PER when the MVP. Do you know who number 1 in PER is in the NBA right now?
I'm going to guess it's Joel Embiid.
Yeah, you are right. That is an impressive guess. Yes, it is Joel Embiid. He's also averaging 31 points a game. He's also averaging close to 12 rebounds a game. The number one the team with the best record, no team lower than number 3 tends to win the MVP. Do you know who has the number one record in the East?
The 76ers?
That would be the Philadelphia 76ers, right?
What part of the season are we in? How many games do we have left?
We're entering All-Star game. We're about, what, 40% of the season done?
Okay.
You know?
All right. I'll leave it
now,
there.
Now, I'll say this. Everything is contingent on people being healthy, right? If he gets hit by a bus tomorrow, he's not going to win the MVP. But what I will tell you is the Lakers are losing, and AD's not playing. And when AD, who was considered MVP contender himself, stops playing and the Lakers stop winning, that's a knock against LeBron James, right? Because if LeBron were to win 20 in a row, yeah, he'd be in the mix. But I don't think so because they're losing. You said Giannis. Giannis has won 2 MVPs in a row and he has shit the bed in the playoffs 2 years in a row. Nobody, the last person to win 3 MVPs in a row, you know who that was? Larry Bird in the 1980s. Larry Bird went to the NBA Finals in 2 of those 3 years. Giannis hasn't been to the Eastern Finals. He keeps getting put out before then, right? Or he lost to the Toronto Raptors 2 years ago. So Giannis ain't getting three MVPs, especially with his team not playing well. So that leaves you with Brooklyn. Harden, if he hadn't pissed off all the media types, you know, with his whole fat man, you know, fat suit that he wore at the first beginning of the season and his him sitting out in Houston and all of that, he might be in the mix. But when you got three guys of that level of talent, it's really hard for the second best player on that team to win the MVP. So that takes Brooklyn out. So the question then becomes, who's left? If you take out LeBron, you take out Giannis, and you take out the big three in Brooklyn, the next best player on the docket, in my humble estimation, is Joel Embiid. So I actually think that his odds are far greater than you. But I'm open to a persuasive argument. It won't be persuasive, but it might be compelling. I'm open to a compelling argument for why you think he's not going to win it from a New York Knicks fan.
First of all, that was not a humble estimation.
That wasn't humble. I'm sorry. I was trying.
I feel like we just had a backdoor pilot for a basketball podcast in the middle of our discussion about Palestine. It's like an old school Norman Lear move there. We just, the Jefferson just
exactly.
happened in the middle of all
we
the
just
family.
Jefferson this whole thing, right?
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii.